This is a society, a community, and we need to have some sense for how things are going to go. And our desire here at Colleyville is that our principles of governance be in accordance with what we believe the Bible to teach in terms of how the church especially should be ordered. Although I think there actually are good principles here for any human institution in terms of order. And so this is, you know, this in some ways is sort of the nitty-gritty, the details, but at the same time it's significant. It's significant because we believe as we govern ourselves faithfully according to the principles in Scripture, we actually reflect the life of God together, and that's an important thing. So before we jump in, any questions, any outstanding questions from last week, any things we talked about? Did you guys have outstanding questions about? Okay, very good. All right, so I've written up this little sort of guide that hopefully will give you sort of something you could take home, and I don't know if you want to keep it, but if you wanted to, you could. And it would sort of have some, you know, sort of question and answer, little quick and easy guide, hopefully, to how church government works here at Colleyville. And I'll just make a few comments before we jump into this in detail. And I'll say this, and as you think about the sort of history of the church, especially history of the church since the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century, there have been sort of two primary models, well, three primary models, but two ends of the spectrum in terms of how church government has worked. One model we might call the Episcopal model. What do we mean by that? What's the sort of Episcopal model of church government? What does Episcopal mean? Episcopus, right, means a bishop, right, overseer in the Greek. And so the Episcopal model of government is one that is fairly hierarchical, right, that is one where you think about the Church of England is structured this way, where you have the Archbishop of Canterbury, and then you have other bishops underneath him, and then you have different priests and others that are underneath him, and sort of the decisions are mostly made. There is some congregational involvement, but mostly decisions are made from the top down. The bishop tells you where you need to go as a priest, where you serve. The bishop makes decisions about church property. The bishop generally makes decisions about what happens within his diocese, his area. And there, you know, to be fair, there's a desire in that. It's not just because Episcopals like hierarchical government, but because they believe that there's something about that that reflects what the Scriptures teach. And I think there's a fair argument for that. I don't think it's necessarily the best way to understand the Scriptures, but there certainly is we have pictures of that in the New Testament in terms of the way that Paul and Timothy function and others. On the other end of the spectrum, we might have something that is sort of, in some ways, the opposite, and that is really, in many ways, kind of an American institution, right? And so that's the model of church government that's congregational, right? What do we mean by congregational, typically? Right. Yeah, congregation makes the decisions, as opposed to somebody somewhere up top telling the congregation how to direct and order their life. And we have, in contrast, the congregation as a whole. So every member of the congregation has an equal voice. Everyone who is part of the local community gets to help make decisions about what that community will do. And generally speaking, that community makes its decisions in isolation from other churches, other communities. And so it's congregational, it's independent, it functions on its own, and that is certainly a strong tradition in especially sort of American evangelicalism. That's a very strong tradition that we see. And again, I think you can have there are some arguments from Scripture as to why it's significant that every member of the body of Christ has the gift of the Holy Spirit, for example. And so it does make some sense that every member of the body of Christ should have a voice, a say in and the government of the church. And so I think on both of those ends of the spectrums, we can say that there are some good sort of principles that both of those systems are trying to reflect. And so just sort of conceptually, as you think about the Presbyterian form of government, the form of government that we have here, I think a sort of simple way to think about it is as sort of a middle way, a kind of middle way between those two extremes, those two poles on the spectrum. The Presbyterian form of government is one that tries to reflect tries to give be sensitive, I think, to the best of both systems in some sense. And so we are a government or a church where many decisions are made by the local congregation. Many of the most significant decisions are made by the local congregation. And yet we are a congregation that has accountability to a larger structure, a larger system. And there's even some oversight that is made, not by one man or one person, but by a collection, a group of men within the presbytery. And then higher than that, the denomination as a whole. And so I would say, as you think about Presbyterian form of government, think about it that way, that it's sort of a middle way between trying to reflect both the strengths of congregational government as well as the strengths of more Episcopal or hierarchical kind of church government. Yeah, Clyde.
Maybe a way to put it in perspective is Episcopal is kind of like the federal government, congregational is kind of like your local town government, and we're like the state.
Yeah, yeah, that'd be one way to think about it. Absolutely.
That's just the way I
think. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it's good, and there are many similarities actually between the way in which the American political system works as a Republican political system and the Presbyterian form of government in terms of representative and collective decisions being made by the body. We don't have an executive branch within the PCA, which is probably a good thing. But
thank you so much for saying that we're a Republican form of government, not a democracy.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, and that is a difference because a democracy would be more purely congregational, right? And I think it's fair to say that the Presbyterian form of government is more Republican in the classical sense of those terms when we talk about political organizations. All right, so let's any other questions or thoughts about that as we just sort of have that big picture idea? Okay, hopefully it helps us situate us some as we think about how things work out on a local level. All right, so here's this first question. So this is really the basic question about government, right? Is who has the authority to make decisions that affect the life of the community? Right? That's basically what we're talking about. We're talking about government, whether it's political government, whether it's government within the institution of the family, whether it's government within a community board or something, or within the church. So who makes the decisions here at Colleyville? And actually, there's a number of answers to that question. There's not just one answer, which I think is important to see. So I'd say that many decisions which affect the life of the church here are made by the session. And we'll talk about what that means in a moment. But there's also the diaconate, and there's the women in the church officers who generally have purview over their areas of ministry. So the deacons who are ordained and set apart as leaders within our body, they're not members of the session. They're not part of many of the decisions the church makes. But they do have purview over particular things within their area of leadership and oversight, which includes the deacons' fund, which is a money that is donated to the deacons for them to distribute as they see wise and fit to those in need. Those are decisions the deacons make without any input from, I can suggest things, but the deacons make that decision. And as well as just generally over makes recommendations with the church budget, they all sorts of things. The deacons make decisions on their own. And the same would be true for women of the church. Women of the church make various decisions about especially the ministries relating to the women in the church, but also many kind of diaconal, a lot of diaconal kind of work in terms of service, in terms of ministry, in terms of hospitality. The women of the church have oversight. Now, of course, both those bodies function under the supervision and authority ultimately of the session. I think it's important to see that there are decisions that are being made by groups outside of the session. We're not a church where the only people that make decisions here are the elders and pastors. I think it's important to say. And then also, we have the congregation as a whole, right? And the congregation as a whole, those who are voting members of the congregation, do make many important decisions that are not up to the session or the deacons, but are actually the congregation members themselves. Okay, so do you guys see that? Sort of, we have actually several layers of decision-making power at work. So what decisions does the congregation make? Generally speaking, here's what the congregation does within our form of government. So if you're a member, these are sort of the decisions you'll be asked to make. The congregation votes to elect or to remove pastors, elders, and deacons, and also votes when a decision needs to be made regarding purchasing or selling church property. And we could also add, the congregation also may vote to actually leave the denomination. That's a decision that can be only made by the congregation. The session can't decide, I can't decide, we're going to leave the PCA. Neither can the elders. That would be a decision that would have to be made by the congregation themselves. So the congregation votes to elect or to remove its leaders, essentially. And this is where we have that idea of a republican form of government, right? Where the congregation is essentially electing representatives to represent its interests and and be a voice for them in the government of the church. And we all, or you all at least, those of you that were here last spring, experienced this reality when I came and candidated, and there was a committee that was assembled. That actually, the committee was actually voted on by the congregation as well and represented them in that sense. There was nominations and then an election of committee members to look for a new pastor when Pastor Smith resigned. And then, of course, the committee made a recommendation to you all that I would be the candidate to be the next pastor. But none of that was sufficient, right? It wasn't sufficient. The elders met with me, and they seemed to be okay with it, and talked with the deacons and the search committee. All of those people seemed to be happy to put me forward as a candidate to be the pastor here. But none of that was sufficient. It required a vote of the congregation in order for that to take place. And so, of course, that happened last May, where I came and spent a weekend with my family, and y'all got to know me a little bit, at least, before you had a meeting to make that decision. And so that's just sort of an illustration, right, a picture of how that happened. That'll happen again here. We just received officer nominations, as many of you hopefully know, here at the church, which means that we have several men that have been nominated for both elder and deacon in our church. And so what'll happen next is that the session will have an opportunity to discuss those nominations and make sure that we, as part of the government of the BCO, the part of the church, that those nominations are valid, essentially, that these are men that are have the qualities that are necessary for these offices in the church. And then I will spend some time over the next probably 8 or 9 months, actually, working with these men, training them, meeting with them, reading books together, talking about leadership in the church. But again, none of that will be, and then those men will be examined by the session, and if they pass, they'll be put forward before the congregation. But again, none of that will be sufficient, right? I don't have the power to handpick leaders here, neither do the elders of the church. The congregation will make that final decision about whether those men will serve as leaders in the church. And again, in addition to this, if we're going to make a purchase property, if we're going to sell this church property, that would be a decision that only the congregation could make. Any questions about that? Yeah, Martha. Great question. Thank you. Yeah, they're not the same thing. They're essentially what we're trying to do with the office of elder and deacon within the Presbyterian form of government is to reflect a distinction that we see in the New Testament between the office of the presbyter and the office of the diakonos, which is more of the servant leadership office. And so we would say that the presbyter is the office of oversight, of government within the church, and the office of deacon is one more of service. It's still an office of leadership in the sense that the deacons are meant to lead the church in the service to the body and outside of the body, but it is not a direct office of oversight in the same way. And we should say also the office of presbyter, the office of elder, is not one that's just... We shouldn't just see it as kind of a oversight over the pragmatics of the church, right, the logistics. The elders also have oversight for the spiritual care of the people in the church, the congregation members, along with the pastor. Ultimately, the pastor is the chief shepherd in the church, but the elders function as under-shepherds, in a sense, with the pastor to help shepherd the spiritual care of the church. It's elders and deacons, yep. Mm-hmm. Great question. Yeah. This church has 3 elders presently, in addition to myself. Technically, I'm an elder as well. A teaching elder is the distinction that's made in the Presbyterian Church. There's myself, and then there's three ruling elders, Lauren Clark, who's right there, Aaron Gentry, who's in the back, and Jamie Pretty, who's not with us this morning, are the three ruling elders in the church. And our church also has three deacons presently, Ben Arnold, who's teaching Sunday school right now, Shane Gibbons is a deacon, and then Mark Scott is a deacon. And Mark also functions as the treasurer of the church in the sense that he helps make sure our books are the way they should be. I should say, Mark's not doing the accounting. We have an outside firm that handles that, so no one in the church is actually doing that aspect of things. Yeah. Does that help, Martha, at all? Mm-hmm. Yes. Right. There is not presently that kind of thing. And I think it's something that all of us in the session desire to reflect in some sense, to figure out a way for us to distinguish the congregation in particular groups that an elder would have oversight over, special kind of oversight over. Of course, the elders would all maintain oversight over the whole body, but a way for there to be more... more intimate kind of shepherding and care, yeah. And that's something that we've had discussions about and are the process of sort of figuring out what's the best way to do that. Yeah, and I think that's a good model. It's one that I've seen before where you could call it different things. You could call it flocks. You could call it parishes. You could call it, you know, care groups. Whatever you call it, the principle is the same. Oversight over a particular group of the church in a special way. Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, Joe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. Historically? That's a good question. I don't know if I know the answer to that question. Do you answer that question, Mark? Lauren? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my understanding of Presbyterian church government is that it comes out of the Scottish tradition. But I don't know exactly what the historical roots are in terms of that distinction. Yeah, Anne? Were you going to add something? Yeah, good. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and that's something that Presbyterian churches are free to do. The session is free to designate certain members of the congregation to have oversight over particular areas. And missions would be a good example of one that many churches have. We need to begin to do that again. So a committee might be designated to say, you know, we want you to maintain contact with these missionaries and to make recommendations regarding increases or decreases in support, or new missionaries we should consider, so those kinds of things.
We have a relationship.
Yeah, right. That'd be the kind of thing that the missions committee might. And I think that's one of the advantages of diversifying the leadership pool and not having it all decisions made by the elders. Is that you give different members of the body an opportunity to use their gifts and their perspectives, which, you know, we're finite men, and so we can't have all those perspectives. Sure. Yeah. Right. That's the kind of, that when you enable and you empower the congregation to have leadership, have responsibility, you get to see different ways which the body can serve, which I think is a good thing. I certainly want to be the case here. Any other questions about those things? Yeah, Nathan.
I was going to say, going back to the session, the structure of the session,
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very unique.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, absolutely. So the distinction between the teaching and ruling elder? Yeah. Really, the distinction between teaching and ruling elder is one of function and calling, not authority so much, which is an important thing to say within the Presbyterian model of government. Within the session, the collective body, myself and the three ruling elders, all of us have an equal voice, so to speak. We don't really take a lot of votes on our session, but if we did, we'd have an equal vote. I serve as the moderator of the session. That's part of the function of the teaching elder's office, the pastor's office, which means that I set the agenda for the meetings, I lead the meetings, those kinds of things. But I function on an equal level in terms of authority with the other elders. And that is also true denominationally. So in the presbytery, when the presbytery gathers together, there's equal voice between those who are teaching elders and those who are ruling elders. And the same is true denominationally. When the General Assembly gathers once a year and makes decisions for the life of the denomination, there's an equal voice given to ruling and teaching elders in terms of authority. And even many committees are required to have a certain number of each kind of elder to give good diversity and representation. And so in terms of authority, the offices are the same. In terms of function, there are differences, though. For example, only a teaching elder, a pastor, has the authority within our denomination to, not authority, the maybe authority, the ability to administer the sacraments. And so it would not be proper within our system of government for one of the ruling elders to administer the Lord's Supper or to baptize a baby or a person. It would also, if a ruling elder was going to preach with any regularity in the church, they would have to be licensed by the presbytery. And so the office of the ministry of the word is given specifically to the teaching elder, to the pastor, as a responsibility. Now, of course, the elders have oversight, and hopefully they're, you know, paying attention to my sermons and making sure that they aren't erroneous. But in terms of the responsibility to actually sit down and write the sermon and to study God's word, that's the office of the teaching elder, generally speaking. Ruling elders can preach, of course, but not regularly unless they've been licensed by the presbytery. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a Greek.
Why do we call ourselves Presbyterians instead of Baptist or Episcopalians or whatever?
It's from the word presbytos in the Greek. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That means overseer or elder. Yep. Mm-hmm. That's, yeah, Lauren, you want to add to that?
I was going to add to what.
Yeah, please do. Good. Good, yeah, right. Good. No, that's very helpful. And I would say, too, as we think about the Old Testament, how it functions within these, the way these roles work themselves out, I think a helpful way to think about it is the office of the teaching elder is one that comes out of the Levitical priesthood, the tribe that is set apart within the Old Testament to care spiritually for the people. And use a lot of principles there, right? Even the livelihood of the Levitical tribe was the responsibility of the other 11 tribes, which is the same with myself and my family. My livelihood is dependent on y'all's generosity and gifts. But you also had, what we see in the Old Testament is you also have elders at the gate. You also have men who have been set apart by the people who are making decisions. You see that in the book of Ruth, for example. You see that in Exodus 18, where Jephthah comes and helps Moses designate how to structure the people of Israel, and there's oversight given over different amounts of people. And so I think you have pictures of in the Old Testament of how these roles work themselves out. It's not a direct parallel. Of course, we're going through Christ, through the New Testament, but I think there are sort of echoes that we see back in the Old Testament. Yeah, Aaron. Mm-hmm. Good.
Like you were saying, if the body chose, they could leave the PCA.
Right.
And the presbytery preserves the teaching.
It's true.
Maintains the orthodoxy by keeping the teaching elders apart from the body.
That's a good question. That's a good point. Yeah, if you all voted to leave the PCA, I wouldn't necessarily. That would not necessarily affect. I mean, affect my relationship to you all potentially, but.
We don't influence.
Right. You don't have the power to pull me out of the PCA. Yeah. Only the presbytery can release me from that. That's a good point. Yeah. Okay. Let's continue through here. And we'll stop whenever at any point for questions that you guys might have. So who's on the session at Colleyville? And we've already mostly answered this, but just to reiterate. So the session members, I think an important way to think about the session is if you're going to be on the session, you have to be elected to that office by the congregation, to that role. So the session are the pastors and elders that have been elected by the congregation and ordained to this office. So in many churches, that means there's one pastor on the session. But as churches grow often, there's an opportunity within our denomination to call additional pastors to help with the pastoral ministry in the church, to help with the preaching, the teaching, the pastoral care, the administration of sacraments, all these different roles that the pastor has. And so when a church calls a pastor, it has a decision to make. It can either call an assistant pastor or an associate pastor. It's important to say that the assistant pastor doesn't mean assistant to the pastor. It is a pastoral role, but it is one of assistance, as opposed to an associate pastor, which is a role where the associate pastor, in many ways, comes alongside the senior pastor and partners with him in ministry. And so there are different ways in which these men would be called. An assistant pastor would be called by the session. And so the session would vote to say, we want X John Doe to come and serve our congregation as an assistant pastor. Now that man would have authority within the congregation in the sense that he would be preaching the word, administering the sacraments, serving pastorally. But he would not have authority in the sense that he would not be part of the session. He would not be part of the body that would be making decisions about the body generally or especially in regard to church discipline. He would not have that kind of authority. And the reason for that is because he would not have been elected by the congregation members. Does that make sense? So there's a desire to preserve the right of oversight to those who have been elected by the congregation themselves and not sort of just chosen by the leaders of the congregation. In contrast, an associate pastor would be a pastor that would be put forward before the congregation in much the similar way that I was put forward and then voted on by the congregation to serve as an associate pastor. And so because that person would be voted on by the congregation, they would serve on the session in a equal kind of authority to the other pastors and elders on that session. Does that make sense, that distinction? No, it's a little bit confusing. That's next question basically covers that that point. Is it possible to have a pastor in the church who's not part of the session? And the answer is yes. The session can call assistant pastors. And usually those pastors, assistant pastors, are given oversight over a very particular part of the body, maybe youth or children's ministry or some particular kind of demographic. And often their calls are not indefinite, but for sort of, you know, this is going to help us address this time, this role for a certain period. And it's not usually a role someone stays in, you know, for years and years and years at a church. I also say there's no equivalent here to an assistant pastor for ruling elders, right? So there's no assistant elder that is potentially called by the congregation. But we should say that the session does have the authority within our Book of Church Order, to designate men or women in the congregation to be assistants to the deacons, and that's an official role that exists within our form of polity. Men or women can be designated by the session as assistants to the deacons to help them in their ministry and their work in the church. Does that make sense? It's not something you see a whole lot within the PCA. I'm not sure why that is, actually. I think it's a pretty good idea. But it's not something that happens a lot. But that does exist in terms of... And those men or women are not ordained. There's no ordination that happens. But it is a special designation, a special role in the church that can be given. Where did my water go? Any questions about that? Yeah, Joe. Not at all.
Is there a moderator or like a leader that serves a term for the General Assembly? And
yeah, good question. Great question. The answer is yes. So when the presbytery gathers, when the representatives, when the pastors, the teaching elders within a certain area, and any ruling elders that have been elected for that meeting by their bodies to represent them gather, there is a moderator that in the same way that I moderate a session meeting, would moderate the presbytery meeting, would run it, would set the agenda, would make, you know, different decisions that could be challenged by the group, but he would lead it. And the same is true for General Assembly, which is when the denomination as a whole gathers. And so, yes, there are moderators who serve particular lengths of terms. I know in Missouri, where I previously served, the moderator served for 2 years, and it alternated between teaching elder and ruling elder every 2 years. I don't know, it was probably about the same. Yeah, probably the same in North Texas. I'm not sure that that's something that's codified by our BCO in terms of the alternate, or it might just be a sort of practice tradition. And then the General Assembly, a new moderator is elected every year. So a moderator only serves for 1 year. Really, his authority just extends for the four or five days that the, you know, of the meeting. I mean, it continues in the sense if things come up, if a committee needs to be appointed or something, he can do that. But mostly his authority really is just for those 4 or 5 days. But every year, and that also alternates between a teaching and ruling elder, traditionally.
So the previous General Assembly, I guess the moderator leader was Dr. Chappell.
That's correct. Yeah, so Dr. Chappell, actually one of my professors at Covenant Seminary when I was in school there, was the moderator. He's a teaching elder, he's a pastor, and so next, or this coming June, we'll elect a ruling elder to serve as moderator.
So it'll go like that, a teaching elder, mm-hmm. ruling elder, teaching elder,
back and forth.
That's great. Okay.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and again, that's just a desire. It's a desire to reflect diversity in terms of the different offices. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah, Bethany. Yeah, great question. Great question, yeah. Mm-hmm. There is a requirement. So the requirements within the BCO are, let's see if I can do this off the top of my head. So there's a requirement for a master's degree. It is not specific to an MDiv, but there is a requirement for a man who's ordained to the office of teaching elder to have a master's level of education in theology. And so that's the academic. There's also a requirement, a man who's going to be become a teaching elder in our denomination is examined in his competency of Greek and Hebrew languages, which does not necessarily have to come from and studying at a school, but, you know, 98% of the time that's how it happens. You know, it's possible you could just teach yourself or learn, you know, whatever, however you would do that, and then pass those exams on your own. But typically, that happens through studying at a seminary. That's how it happened for me. In addition, a man is also examined in the areas of theology, English Bible knowledge, in addition to Hebrew and Greek competency, church government, sacraments, and church history. So those five areas of competency have to be shown to the presbytery, usually through... How it worked for me was I took a series of written exams for each of those five areas, and then I had to submit a paper to show my competency in addition to my seminary transcripts with original languages. I had to preach a sermon that was examined. I then had to meet with a committee that examined me orally on all of those areas for several hours. And then finally, after all that happened, went before the whole presbytery and was examined again orally before the whole presbytery in all five of those areas. The final area would be just Christian experience, just making sure that you have a valid testimony, essentially, and call to the ministry. And there's also, I'm adding on to this. So within our denomination, this is in some ways the strength and the weakness of the Presbyterian system, is you have to do a whole lot to be a pastor, which candidly held us back in terms of, you think, historically in the American sort of history, the reason why, and historically speaking at least, there are so many more Methodist and Baptist churches in America than Presbyterian is largely part to different standards for how you became a pastor. And so it was much more difficult for Presbyterians to get pastors, where because the it was just more open for Methodists and Baptist ecclesiology, it was much easier to find men to go out and preach the gospel. I mean, I think you can make arguments on both sides as to which approach was the correct one, but whatever you think was right, I think there are some connections there in terms of historically how things have worked out in this country in that regard. And so in addition to all the things I just listed, you also have to serve at least a year internship under the oversight of a presbytery and before you can be ordained. And so that's also something that's a part of the process at a church typically. Yeah. Any other questions about that? Yes, sir. Yeah, good question. Our presbytery is called the North Texas Presbytery. I can't give you exact dimensions, but it's basically north of, I know that it's north of Austin, north of Houston. I'm not sure exactly where the line is. But, I mean, it's mostly, you know, around this area and then north and goes into Oklahoma. The entire state of Oklahoma is part of our presbytery. I believe a section of Arkansas is part of our presbytery. Yes. I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm still learning what panhandle means. It does include Lubbock. Yeah, I know that. Yeah. It's a big presbytery. It's a lot of churches. It's probably one of the largest in the PCA. There's actually discussion right now at our last presbytery meeting. A committee has been set up to evaluate whether it's time for Oklahoma to form its own presbytery, which would give them more local, you know, kind of oversight over their decisions and help them not have to drive so far every quarter. Yes, Carrie. Both. It's probably not geographically large in comparison to many presbyteries. There are many presbyteries, especially in the West. The PCA is a very geographically denomination. It's still very geographically centered on the Southeast, and so as Texas, we're sort of on the border of that. We're not really part of that. But there are many, many presbyteries. Like, you know, if you're in Alabama or Mississippi, your presbytery is, you know, maybe 80 miles wide or something. But if you go out west or you go to the Northeast, they become much larger, especially in the West. The West, we have presbyteries like Northern California, which includes like half the state of California, all of Utah, all of Nevada, all of Hawaii. I mean, it's huge geographically. You also have presbyteries like in the sort of the Southwest. Presbytery of the Southwest, I think, includes New Mexico and Arizona and maybe part of Texas too. I'm not sure. So in our presbytery, maybe 50, I would guess. It's a lot. It's a lot. When we gather for presbytery, I would guess that they were well over 100 men, maybe 120 men at least there last week when we met in Fort Worth. I was in a large presbytery in Missouri because of the seminary, largely. Our denominational seminary is located in St. Louis, where I went to school, Covenant Seminary. But this presbytery is larger in terms of numbers. And I think a lot of that's just because there's been so much church planting in the Dallas-Fort Worth metro area. Most of the presbytery is located within, you know, 60 miles of where we're at. Yeah, Frank. Frank can maybe provide some historical context.
The Presbyterian boundaries are not fixed.
Right. Good. Yep.
In the beginning, there was only one.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Right. There was only one Texas Presbytery earlier in the history of the PCA, and now there are three. There's North Texas, South Texas, and Houston Metro. Houston has its own presbytery. And that, you know, that would be an option one day. You could have a Dallas-Fort Worth Metro Presbytery, potentially. And they're always changing. Every General Assembly, some presbytery is changing its borders. Yeah, Martha. Yeah. No, that's a good question. Yeah, so just a kind of quick and dirty sort of overview of Presbyterian history. There was basically one Presbyterian church in America up until the time of the Civil War. And around that time, there was a split that happened, largely over the question of how much involvement should the church have in political affairs, essentially, things that happened within society. And the Northern Church said, and especially in regard to the question of slavery, was the big touching point for this. The Northern Church basically said the church should have interaction in political affairs. It should have a voice. It should say something. The Southern Church said, no, the church is only spiritual and should not say anything about slavery or anything else. And so there was a split that happened around the time of the Civil War. And I should say, I think the side that we came out of was wrong. That's my personal opinion in that regard. Which is the Southern Church. So the North and South split, and that continued for a long time, actually until the 70s or 80s, I believe. There's a reunification of those two groups. Basically, what happened was the Northern Church drifted towards what we might call liberalism more quickly. Their central seminary was Princeton Seminary, you know, one of the oldest universities and seminaries in our country. And over time, Princeton began to drift into liberalism. And we had what was called, you had a man called J. Gresham Machen, who led a group out of Princeton Seminary that eventually became sort of split into the Bible Church and the OPC. I got that right, Lauren? Bible Presbyterian Church, right. So there were two groups that came out of that exodus, sort of a conservative movement out of the liberalism of the Northern Presbyterian Church, one called the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, one called the Bible Presbyterian Church. Lauren's father is actually a member of the Bible Presbyterian Church, right? Is that correct? Yeah. And so that happened in the 1920s, I believe, 20s and 30s. Generally speaking, the Southern Presbyterian Church, although I think it made a tremendous error in the question of slavery and the voice a church should have in social affairs of the world, of the place where it's located, I think it made a mistake in that area. It did generally remain more conservative in terms of inerrancy of the Bible, in terms of, the reasons like Machen left and those other men left was because there was really questioning of central Christian doctrines like the resurrection of Christ or the virgin birth or the divinity of Christ. You know, things that were not just sort of Presbyterian distinctives, but Apostles' Creed kind of distinctives. And so that was the reason why the split happened there. In contrast, the Southern Church remained largely fairly conservative on those questions and was not ordaining men who held contrary opinions on those points. In general, and if you look at most of the history of the mainline church within America, whether you're talking about Baptist or Lutheran or Methodist or Anglican, Episcopal, all those denominations within the 50s and 60s began to move further left in terms of those questions. So there was within the PCA, or the Southern Presbyterian Church rather, there was a gradual movement left on those questions. In addition, the question of ordination of women to pastoral office was a significant thing that happened within the Presbyterian Church. So all of those things together, it wasn't any one issue, but it was a number of things that led to the decision in 1973 for the men who formed the PCA to leave the southern branch of the Presbyterian Church. So we come out of that branch. Since that time, this is where it gets even more confusing, the northern and southern mainline denominations, the larger bodies that stayed, so to speak, joined again, I believe in 1980s sometime. And so that happened. So now there's only one Presbyterian Church of the United States of America, which is the main Presbyterian denomination. If you hear, you know, I grew up Presbyterian, that's typically what people mean. I mean, it's still much larger. The PCA is about 350,000, maybe 400,000. The PCUSA, the mainline denomination, is still about 2 million. So there's still a large distinction. Now I'll say that the trajectories are you know, favoring the PCA in terms of the growth versus the decline. The PCA is not growing as fast as it once was, but it's not in decline like the PCUSA is. The PCUSA, I mean, the statistics are really kind of staggering. If you look at the median age of members of the church is in the 60s. If you know the median, you know the church has declined every single year for a long time, for decades at this point, in terms of membership. And so that's just kind of the reality of the situation, regardless of you know how you explain that. Does that help at all? So since the reunification, I think it's fair to say that the PCUSA has moved in an accelerated pace towards what we might call liberalism in terms of being open to a number of different things theologically and most recently agreeing that it is acceptable to ordain men or women who are not sexually chaste, to which includes homosexual activity, but actually doesn't, it's actually not limited to homosexual activity. It's sexual chastity in general is no longer required of a minister in the PCUSA. Yes, Ann.
Just a note of the size of Presbyterian Northwest, the OPC. At one point, we went from Alaska to Southern Oregon, from the Pacific Coast to Eastern Montana.
Yeah, and the OPC has much larger presbyteries because there are much fewer presbyteries. Then the PCA at this point has about 80, 82, I think is the most recent number, 83, something like that, presbyteries. I'm not sure how many the OPC has, but it's a lot less, maybe a dozen or 15 or something. And the relative size of the denominations, the PCA is about 350, 400,000. The OPC is about 30,000. So they're, you know, if you kind of think about the relative size of those are the three major. We might say historically Presbyterian. We also have the Evangelical Presbyterian Church, the EPC, which is not as historically Presbyterian. It's smaller than the PCA. It's about 200,000, I believe. Yes, John.
You said there's also the ARP.
Yeah, ARP, that's true. Yep. They have their own story. They were never a part of any of that. God bless them, you know. They came straight from Scotland. Yeah, no, that's a good question. I mean, I think
because the OPC initially was very strong on their position statements and stuff. I mean, they were the first ones against
right.
Right.
Yeah.
So
I would say, I mean, I think, you know, ultimately the answer is just the work of the Spirit, but I think that pragmatically speaking, I think you've seen within the PCA a willingness to like our three taglines are be faithful to the scriptures, faithful to the Great Commission, and something else. But those two things are central. Faithful to the scriptures and faithful to the Great Commission. There's always been emphasis on evangelism and sort of sharing the gospel in an evangelistic way. And so I think what you've seen in the PCA is a willingness to, again, for better, for whatever you think about this, to accommodate itself to different contexts. And so there's a lot of diverse, like if you go to five different PCA churches in this area, you're going to see likely five pretty different worship services and pretty different kind of emphases and whatever, however you want to classify that. In contrast, if you went to five different OPC churches, it would be pretty much the same. Pretty much the same order of worship, pretty much the same style of preaching, pretty much the same kind of flavor in terms of the worship, where in the PCA you might have five different styles of worship, five different patterns of liturgy, five different styles of preaching. And so I think largely that's the explanation, is that the PCA has given its, and that's not even something that I don't know the OPC's history as well as the PCA's. I don't think that's even something that's really codified within the OPC in terms of, I think there's more openness to that, but just in terms of culture, there's a different culture in regards to those kinds of things. The PCA is just much more diverse in terms of the people that are part of it. The PCA is a big tent. The PCA, we've got Tim Keller in the PCA, and we've got some really conservative, like very, very strict kind of guys in the PCA. Yeah, Aaron. I'll get you in short. Care. It's true. Yep. Yeah, the OPC practices representative government at their General Assembly level. So just because I'm a pastor in the OPC doesn't mean I can go to General Assembly. I mean, I could go, I guess, but I couldn't vote or talk. I have to be elected by my presbytery to represent the presbytery. And so even within that, there's more conservative, we might say, in terms of classic political. Yeah, Carrie. The OPC's main seminary historically has been Westminster Theological Seminary, which came out of Princeton, and there have been others. There's also Westminster on the West Coast. Actually, was a Westminster here in Dallas briefly. It's now called Redeemer, and doesn't have any connection to. I think they're fundamentally independent, but historically they've trained a lot of OPC guys. But they don't, like Covenant Seminary or Armitage School is actually directly overseen by our denomination. I don't think the OPC actually has a denominational seminary in that sense. Were you going to say something, Eric? Yeah. Right, that's true. Yep. Right, that's true. Yes, Anne. Yes, that's true. There have been some. And generally, we might say the OPC is just, there, for better or for worse, there's just been a much more narrow perspective theologically on issues, whereas the PCA has been open to a much larger level of diversity in terms of perspectives on which we would say are not essential to, like, for example, the PCA, this is a good example, would permit a man to have different kinds of views on the age of the earth and exactly how creation happened in terms of the science, as long as he affirmed that Adam and Eve were created by God, out of nothing or out of the dust. So there are particular kind of parameters, but there's much more freedom within the PCA. There are men in the PCA that believe the Earth is, you know, whatever the current projection is, you know, billions of years old. 14 and a half. There are not men in the OPC who believe that, unless they've been very smart about how they're holding that position. So that there's much more in OPC, much like you have to say, I believe in six literal 24-hour days of creation, the earth, you know. So does that make sense? Like, just that's one example, but there are many examples of theological positions where the PCA says, and I'm in the PCA, obviously, for a reason, and I personally think that is a strength of the PCA and one that I'm glad our presbytery is one that has different positions within it. I'm glad even our church is one that has different positions within it in terms of the session. And so I think it's actually a strength of the PCA in many ways to have that diversity. To say there are some things that we need to be on the same page on, there's some things we can have diversity on. Do you have a question, Wes? Okay. All right, let's stand and pray. You guys can grab me with any questions later as well. Luis, would you pray for us? Thank you.